Metcast, Saturday, July 14th, 2012. Hey, Met Geeks, it's time for your Metcast, the show for Met Geeks by Met Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the Metcast. Well, it's looking like it was a little bit of a lighter week this week when it comes to Apple and Mac news. Not a ton of stuff going on, but we have some good things to talk about. I guess what's going on is we're waiting on the release of Mountain Lion, and also Apple's getting ready to do its quarterly results call. So we have a little bit of speculation about those things. Actually, some news on Mountain Lion to tell you about here in just a second. But before we dive into everything, I need to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, you can check out their software. Notebook is a great application for all sorts of things. Of course, it's great for taking notes. It's great for doing research and stuff like that. But another really good thing that you can use it for is making lists. It has the ability to put lists in there. You can add checkbox columns so that you can check off items as you've done them. You can set priorities. You can set due dates on things. It's great for making lists if you're getting organized, say, for a trip or something like that. You want to make sure that you don't forget things. You can set up lists for that. If you decide to throw in due dates, you can even have those dates sync up with your calendar, with iCal. You can have stuff show up on your to-do lists. And have that then all sync onto your iPhone, and you'll have your list there. And so it's really this versatile application that you might pick up for one specific use case, say taking notes, and what I found is I come back to it for different things, and the feature set just keeps expanding. They keep adding new features and functionality to it, so it is just truly an awesome application. The latest version is really great. You can check it out and get more information and details over on the website. You can also get a free trial, and so you can check it out before you buy it, but I think you're absolutely going to love it. Get all the information and details over at circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the Maccast. So when Apple announced Mountain Lion, OS X Mountain Lion, and showed it off at WWDC, they gave us a release date, or I guess I should actually say a release month. They let us know it was going to be out in July, and it looks like they are on track to make that happen. Actually, this past week, Apple reportedly released the Gold Master build of Mountain Lion 10.8 to developers. So that means it's pretty much ready to go. Unless they find anything major, this should be the build that actually ends up shipping. As far as when it will actually drop, it could be any time between now and the end of the month, of course. A date that seems very likely would be in about 2 weeks. Apple's going to do its quarterly results call on the 24th. I would imagine they would release it maybe right after that. So I believe the 24th is a Tuesday. Wednesday the 25th, I think, would be a logical date, or maybe Friday of that week, which would get them right in under the July deadline. As far as what you're going to need to have to be able to run Mountain Lion, Apple actually posted the official list of supported Macs on their website, so that's another sign that they're probably getting very close to actually releasing this thing. Oddly enough, most 64-bit capable Intel Core 2 Duo Macs are going to be able to run it, but not all of them. It was believed for a while, I think, that any Intel Core 2 Duo Mac would be able to run Mountain Lion, but on Apple's official list, they have the iMac mid-2007 or newer. For MacBook models, it's going to be the late 2008 aluminum or early 2009 or newer MacBooks. The MacBook Pro is mid to late 2007 or newer. MacBook Airs, the late 2008 or newer. The Mac Mini, early 2009 or newer. Mac Pros, early 2008 or newer. And then the X-Serve is early 2009. So in looking at that list, it seems like generally models that only offer Intel integrated GPUs and not discrete processors are excluded from the Mountain Lion upgrade list. You also, I think, need to have a 64-bit capable Mac, but I think any Intel Core Core 2 Duo is going to fall into that category. So it seems to be somewhat related to the GPU. And if your model only has an Intel integrated GPU, you may not be able to run Mountain Lion. You should run through that list that Apple has posted and make doubly sure. But that seems to be what they're indicating. And also, not all features of Mountain Lion are apparently going to work on all model Macs. So even if your Mac is supported, you might not get all the features and functionality. We don't have the full list yet because it's not released. But a big one that was pointed out this week is AirPlay mirroring, which will apparently only work if you have an iMac, a MacBook Air, or a Mac Mini from mid-2011 or later, or a MacBook Pro from early 2011 or later. And the reason seems to be that you need a Mac that has on GPU H.264 encoding. So you need to be able to do the actual encoding of H.264 on the GPU, and apparently only those models from mid-2011 on or early 2011 on, if you have a MacBook Pro, are going to be capable of doing that. And I think that's going to sting for a lot of people because that's one of those big features that a lot of people are looking forward to. Fortunately, there's some third-party software out there, I believe, stuff like AirParrot, that'll actually allow you to do mirroring with AirPlay, even on current Macs running Lion. So you still could probably fall back on that software to get that to work. But if you want to use the native stuff that's built into Mountain Lion, you are going to have the right GPU to make that happen. Another indication that Apple's getting very close to having Mountain Lion ready to ship is that they did open up app submissions for Mountain Lion capable apps for the Mac App Store this week. So developers have been submitting their applications, getting all of that stuff ready. And that's good news because if you need to get your app update, you're going to be able to go to the App Store if you purchase through there and just have that ready to go. And of course, we're going to have to get a list out of the software that is supported on Mountain Lion and not supported. So I'm a little hesitant about upgrading day one because I'm pretty sure there's going to be some applications that aren't ready to go. Apple added in a lot of that sandboxing stuff. The Apple ID needs to be a requirement for Mountain Lion. So there's some significant things in there. And if an app developer has been dragging their feet and updating their software, it may or may not work. So hopefully we'll have one of those sites that does the list. And once I find out about one of those, I'll be sure to share that information with you. You also do need to have Snow Leopard or Lion installed to be able to do the upgrade. So you need to get those in place. You will be able to upgrade directly from Snow Leopard to Mountain Lion. That's my understanding. I think the key factor is you need access to the Mac App Store. That's going to be the only way you can purchase it. It's going to be sold exclusively through the Mac App Store for $19.99 US. So very reasonably priced on the upgrade. Apple had announced that pricing back at WWDC, and that's just amazing. So Mountain Lion's getting ready to go. It's time for us to start getting our Macs ready. And I am working on putting together some information on exactly some of the steps, some of the procedures that I go through. Of course, I'll be doing a little refresher on how I do my clean installation and stuff like that on a future episode of the MacCast. I have a feeling if Apple releases it in the next week or two, it's going to get pretty crazy. So I'll try and get you that information as soon as possible. I'm still pulling in bits and pieces. So if you run across anything, any articles, any information, or if you have something you typically do when you do a Mac OS upgrade, please share that information. Send some audio comments along or an email or something like that. And we'll try and get us all up to speed on how to best upgrade to Mountain Lion. If you've been using the App Store for a while, the iOS App Store, you've probably noticed that Apple kind of has a set number of categories, and they really haven't changed those categories very much, if at all, since the launch or release of the App Store. Well, about a week ago, they announced an upcoming change for app developers, and it is now official. Apple has added a brand new category to the App Store. It's the food and drink category. So prior to that update, applications like Urban Spoon or the Starbucks app, certain cooking apps, or maybe bartending apps, they were all living in the more general categories of lifestyle or travel. They didn't really have a specific category that necessarily made sense for that type of application. Well, at release of the new section this week, they were able to take about 2,800 food and drink-related applications, move them over to the new category. So that's a pretty sizable category. So it makes sense that they would add that one. I'm really hoping that this is a sign of things to come, because as you look around the App Store, at least in my mind, there are a bunch of different apps that could benefit maybe from a more general or more granular, category listing. And I'm hoping that Apple is working on that. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of applications in there. And I think one of the most common complaints we all hear about, and I'm sure Apple does as well, is app discovery. You know, finding those applications that you're looking for. And as the app lists grow, I think it becomes more and more of a burden for the App Store and iTunes. So there has been, I think, some speculation that Apple may be completely scrapping the current App Store that's kind of in, you know, was sort of shoehorned into iTunes way back when, and maybe doing something completely different. We know that Apple acquired the recommendation application Chomp back in February, and there was a lot of speculation that Apple was planning to use their search algorithms and recommendation technology, the stuff they acquired from Chomp, to hopefully continue to improve iTunes app discovery and maybe some of the organizations. So I don't know if this is laying the groundwork for that, if we're going to see more new categories coming into play. But certainly, I think most of us can agree that Apple needs to do something about the organization and cataloging and just general app discovery of apps in the Mac App Store. I think the only way I find new stuff usually nowadays is just through word of mouth, occasionally with browsing around on the store. But it would be nice if we could go in there and browse more specific categories or do a sort of keyword search or have recommendations given to us. I mean, the Genius thing never really quite worked. So hopefully between these acquisitions and some of these changes, Apple's going to do a little bit better job with the App Store. And we did at least see one new category added this week. If you blinked, you may have missed it, but Apple did release a minor update to iPhoto this week, iPhoto 9.3.1. It fixed an issue where migrating photos from Mobile Me Gallery may have resulted in photos being moved from their original events in your library into a new event called From Mobile Me. That reportedly has been corrected. This didn't actually happen to me, so I'm assuming that if that stuff got moved for you when you migrated your Mobile Me gallery down from Mobile Me, since they shut it down on the 30th, that you would have had your photos moved to this new event. I'm hoping the update would have moved them back to their original location, although I don't know how Apple would have known that. But this reportedly fixes that. If you haven't run iPhoto since the Mobile Me shutdown and you were a Mobile Me customer, I think I mentioned this on a previous MacCast, but it does this nice thing where it pops up and it prompts you, do you want to download your photos from your Mobile Me galleries into iPhoto? And that was this process that was moving them into this special event. In my case, I noticed they were all moved into an album called From Mobile Me, but I didn't notice them being moved around in my library. So if you were affected by that, you probably want to grab this minor update. The update also reportedly addressed an issue where iPhoto would crash when upgrading your library, which is never a good thing. Again, that was something that I didn't experience. And also the update does come just about a month after the 9.3 update. And if you missed that, that was a pretty significant one. And one of the major things in there is they did add support for opening your Aperture 3.3 or later libraries in iPhoto. So if you've missed either of these in the last month or so, you might want to run your software update, get iPhoto updated, or if you purchased iPhoto from the Mac App Store, go ahead and launch the Mac App Store app and go to the updates section to get the update. You can also get it on Apple's support website at apple.com/support. This week, we also saw news that a Russian developer, hacker, I guess you could call him, figured out a way to bypass Apple's in-app purchase system and make in-app purchases for free. The original story I saw over on 9to5Mac said the developer had posted a video and instructions on the way that he used fake certificates and a proxy server to bypass Apple's in-app purchase system and then unlock paid content in some free apps. The hack is should be particularly concerning for developers, I think, because it seems relatively easy to implement, and it doesn't require any hacking or jailbreaking of the iOS device itself. So this all happens outside the iOS device. It's sort of intercepting, I think they call it a man-in-the-middle style attack, basically intercepting the message that would normally get sent to Apple's servers and sending it over to this Russian server, and then getting a reply back to the system saying, yes, the purchase has been made, and you can unlock this in-app purchase content. The scary thing about that, though, too, is that customers who might think that this is an easy way to get purchase content for free, I would be very wary about using a system like this, because the system does require pointing your device at a proxy, and it's presumably one that would be run by the hacker. I guess you could, if you knew how to do this yourself, set it up on your own. But then you're just, if you're using this kind of system or you're doing that, you're just, one, being a huge jerk because you're ripping off app developers who work very hard on this stuff and deserve to get paid for it. But also, you're presumably putting yourself at great risk because you're not just sending little bits of information. There's lots of information that are passed over to the server about your device, about your account, what you're purchasing, the location of your device. So you're giving up a lot of information for saving yourself $1.99 or $1.99 in most cases. It's just ridiculous. So, you know, you could have your information hacked and stolen along with getting your quote unquote free software. Now, the hacker did post on his website a little message that says, "Don't pirate App Store apps." Trying to give the impression that he was mainly releasing this or putting this video out as a warning to Apple. But 9to5 claimed in their piece that he had been helping others troubleshoot the solution. I also went and looked at his blog, and he had some posts up there about Apple actually responding to this, blocking the IP of his server so that the hack wouldn't work, asking the community to set up transparent proxies so that he could get through. He also noted that his PayPal account was limited by Apple, I guess, or by PayPal, rather. Apple very likely lodged a complaint against this guy. And another post, he says he's asking Apple to contact him and that he would share the details about his experience in doing the hack and give them the information in exchange for a free iPhone 5. So sort of extorting Apple for the information. So I highly doubt that he's a white hat or even a gray hat hacker, just trying to do a good thing and, you know, help Apple tighten up their system. So you're not going to want to trust a guy like this with your information. So don't be using this hack. Either way, it is a pretty serious hole that Apple is going to have to deal with. Hopefully they're going to address it relatively quickly. Based on the reactions from the posting on his website, it does seem like they have taken some steps. They're going to have to probably do some deeper steps to better protect the apps and developers and stuff like that. The one thing that Apple does do is they do give developers an API where they can verify their store receipts. They have to do a little extra programming when they're programming the in-app purchase, but Apple has the documentation on their website. It just isn't required. So with those APIs, they can request a token that's going to verify that the message coming back is coming from Apple's servers. And if they do that, their app will not be affected. So I was saying earlier that only some applications seem to be affected by this. The apps that used this verification API are not affected by the hack. So that's good news. My guess is that after this incident, even without a requirement from Apple, though, many more developers are going to be aware of this API and going to implement it in their systems, in their in-app purchase systems, so that they can verify the receipts coming in. And ultimately, that's going to be a good thing. I'm curious why Apple didn't make it a requirement from the very beginning. I have to imagine that they have good reason for doing that, but they may need to change that policy in light of this hack. So we'll stay tuned and see what happens on that front. I'll hopefully be able to talk to some developers about, you know, how concerning this sort of stuff is, but does seem a little bit like a glaring hole that Apple left open. I'm sure they're going to tighten it up at this point. And then finally, as I was saying at the top of the episode, Apple's quarterly results call is coming up here in a couple weeks. We're starting to get reports and speculation from analysts on how Apple's been doing, how they're faring in the marketplace. And of course, everything is looking relatively positive. Nielsen posted their Q2 2012 numbers for U.S. handset sales, and they pretty much show more of the same that we've expected. Apple and Android leading the pack. Actually, together, Apple and Android-based devices account for about 85% of the U.S. smartphone market. In looking at just the operating system in the U.S., buyers choose Android-based devices about 51% of the time, according to the report. iPhones have 34% of the share, and then BlackBerry came in at 9%, with Windows Mobile coming in at 3%. But if you go back to those numbers and then you break down the handsets by manufacturer, the iPhone is still clearly the top-selling smartphone on the market. Apple, of course, stays at a 35% share of the smartphone market in the U.S. Android devices break down with Samsung being on top. I find it funny, you know, Samsung is the one Apple's most aggressively going after in the sort of copying of Apple's devices. And we know that Apple and Samsung are pretty tight partners. And so they do have the lead in the non-iPhone hardware market. For smartphones, they have 17% of the market. HTC and Motorola are the next two with 14% and 11% respectively. In looking at his numbers for the second quarter of 2012, Charlie Wolf at Needham & Company thinks that we'll see a hefty jump in iPad sales, with iPhone numbers actually declining a little bit as folks have been waiting for the iPhone 5 release. Wolf says that iPad shipments for the June quarter, he expects to reach 20 million units, which is a huge number. I think he's a bit more bullish on iPad sales than most other analysts. 20 million units would represent about a double, or actually more than double, increase of the 9.25 million units that Apple sold in the same quarter last year. On the iPhone, he's saying that the numbers are going to be around 27 million units, which would be down significantly from the 35 million units that Apple shipped last quarter. But again, we've got really strong rumors of the iPhone 5 coming out in the fall, so a lot of people are likely holding off on making any new iPhone purchases. And moving over to look at Macs, we have numbers in from IDC and Gartner. They are both reporting that in Apple's second quarter of 2012, they expect U.S. Mac market share to have grown, although they differ slightly on how much. IDC predicted that Apple shipped around 1.81 million Macs during the quarter, putting their expected PC market share at around 11.4%. That would be up from 10.3% a year ago. Gartner, on the other hand, has their numbers a little bit higher. They're saying that Apple sold 1.91 million Macs, garnering about 12% of the U.S. PC market share. The interesting thing about the different unit sales numbers is that in the same quarter last year, Apple sold 1.83 million Macs, and actually they both agree on that number, I believe. So by IDC's numbers, year-over-year sales would have declined, while if you use Gartner's figure, the sales would have slightly increased. So that 0.1 million units is significant in determining whether Apple's year-over-year Mac unit sales grew or declined just a bit. Either way you look at it, though, Apple is generally doing better than the PC industry as a whole, which saw an overall sales decrease of about 10.6%. So Apple's not going to be dropping that far, even if they did slightly slide in their year-over-year numbers. Not surprisingly, consumer use of smartphones and tablets are being cited as one of the main contributing factors in the lack of demand and for consumers delaying purchases of new PCs, and then directly involving or directly relating to the slowing and decline of the PC industry sales as a whole. And, you know, that goes along with the whole feeling that Apple and Tim Cook has that we're entering this post-PC era and that we're going to have these post-PC devices also working in conjunction and possibly eventually replacing desktop PCs and notebooks, at least for some consumers. That's one of those ones that I think is going to be a long time coming for me. I think I'm going to be a multiple device person for quite a while, and I think a lot of you may be as well. But, you know, for certain people, My in-laws, for example, they only have an iPad and they absolutely love it, and it's probably all they need. And it's those sorts of numbers that are going to be reflected when we start getting these reports and stuff like that, and we see these declines happening. So I think Apple's even admitted it. Tim Cook has admitted that they do expect Mac sales to be cannibalized a little bit by tablets. And smartphones may be a bit more of a stretch, but certainly iPads are causing some models of the Mac to not get as robust sales as they had in the past. On the last episode of the MacCast, I believe I was talking about some issues I was having with YouTube videos and YouTube playback, and I actually had discovered a solution where I was part of the YouTube HTML5 beta. I had gone to that special page, I think it was youtube.com/HTML5, and you could sign up and opt in to be in their beta program. And it seems like YouTube is having some issues with their HTML5 player. I think as they've tried to add more features and functionality to it, it's gotten a little bit wonky. And so the fix to it that I discovered was to go back and opt back out of that program, and then rather than having to run Flash, actually running the software Click to Flash, which has a feature where it will actually convert the Flash video over to HTML5 video and give you a more standardized built-in player in Safari. And that worked fairly well for me. I was able to use that, and my video playback was smoothed out and working really well. And it has the added benefit of actually disabling all of your Flash. Click to Flash is this program that when you hit a page that has Flash content on it, you can set it up so that you just get little placeholders, and then you can click on that area, and then it will actually load that Flash content more on demand. So it reduces some of the resources and stuff like that. It's a really nice add-on extension for Safari. But Jason sent me an email to point out another solution that he had learned about from Don McAllister over at Screencasts Online. And it does a similar function, but it doesn't disable Flash completely on other sites. And actually, that might work out better for some people. I know that I myself have certain websites that I need Flash to run on. I think Click to Flash does have a whitelist, but you know, maybe you want to have Flash in most cases, but you still want to fix this video issue, this video playback issue that you might encounter on YouTube. And so the software that he pointed me to is called YouTube 5. It's from Vertical Forest. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And it essentially does the same thing. It does this on-the-fly Flash conversion to HTML5. It does it for YouTube, for Vimeo, and Facebook, although I was having some issues with the Vimeo conversion. It was giving me some errors, so I actually had to disable that one. The nice thing about that is you can enable it or disable it for each service individually. So if you only want to have it working on Facebook and YouTube, you can do that, and you can leave Vimeo using the built-in Vimeo HTML5 player or the Flash player that's over there. Although I found that Vimeo's HTML5 player for me seems to work very, very well. So didn't need to use this solution for that site. The one thing that I like about this one is it does have a really nice looking custom HTML5 player. So with the Click to Flash player, it actually just gives you the standard, I think, Apple's built-in HTML5 player. This one has a little more customization to it. It does support the full screen playback. It has a nice feature where you can click and it will allow you to select the playback resolution. And you can also very easily click a button and have it go back to the default player. So if you want to force it back to using the Flash player on YouTube, for example, you can do that. And I found that I needed to do that because I was missing the watch later button, which I occasionally need to use because I have a if this then that script set up that allows me to flag anything that I watch later on YouTube and send it over to Pocket, which is my read later client that I use on my iOS devices, and it has pretty good support for video. So I like to do that. So it's unfortunate that that functionality gets lost when you convert to the HTML5 player, but otherwise it works really, really great. And one of the nice things is you don't need to have Flash installed at all to use the YouTube 5 player. I'm not sure about with Click to Flash if its converter would work even if you didn't have the Flash player installed. And like I said, sometimes I need Flash in certain applications. Like Google Analytics has some reports and some graphs and stuff like that that are generated with HTML5. So this extension actually for me might work out a little bit better than Click to Flash. Not saying that Click to Flash isn't great, because I know a lot of people really love it, but in certain situations, depending on your needs, it's nice to be able to have options like this. The one thing I will say about this solution, and I think also the Click to Flash solution, is there is a slight delay when you want to go to watch a video, and it's because it's having to generate the HTML5 code on the fly, so it's going to have to go in there and parse out the Flash and then create the HTML5 code and player and put it into place on the page. And so there is a little bit of delay before you can start watching the video, but that's a much better experience. I'd rather have a short delay up front and have my video play smoothly, as opposed to the issues I was having with YouTube, which was it was completely choppy. The audio would start playing. There would be no video. It was a mess. So either one of these solutions works great. And I'm now switched over to this new YouTube 5 version because it works a little bit better for me. Another bit of follow-up I have from the last MacCast is we had a conversation. Somebody was getting some new MacBook Pros, a new MacBook Pro and a new MacBook Pro with Retina with the USB 3 drives, and wanted to know about booting the Mac off of an external USB 3 drive. And he had this concept where he wanted to be able to have his operating system installed on the external drive and then take that drive between two different Macs so that he always had the same application, same operating system, same user folder, but was using different machines, one at work and one at home, and was preparing for that as he was waiting for his new Retina MacBook Pro to come, and was trying to test it out with his brother's, or I think it was his brother's MacBook Air, and found that he wasn't able to boot the MacBook Air with the external drive. So I had thrown out the question to ask if there was, you know, maybe some driver updates that needed to come or something that needed to happen. And I'm hopefully getting his name right. I think it's Jeff emailed me and made a good point that the drive that he had built, I believe, was cloned over from an old Mac. And so if he had that Mac with OS X on it and had been just running the standard software updates to update that operating system, then it may not have all of the firmware updates and information and stuff that it needs to be able to boot a newer Mac. And I believe I had commented on some comments that John Foster had made on the MacCast forums about the fact that Mac OS X, the retail disk that you get, is a universal installer in terms of it should be able to boot any Mac that is out on the market. The thing about that is that version that you installed is going to have the information for all of the Macs that are currently on the market. And in the case of the new MacBook Pros, obviously, they've just been released. Apple very often has a different version, slightly modified version of the operating system that comes pre-installed on those devices. So you may not have all the latest and greatest information and stuff contained within the version that you were cloning from if you're cloning from an existing Mac and you've just run the standard software updates. So Jeff's advice was that you may need to go to Apple's website, download the most recent combo update for your version of Mac OS X, and run that so that you make sure you get all the universal drivers and everything for the very latest models. The only problem with this situation, as he rightly pointed out, is that a new version of Mac OS X, a new combo updater, has not been released since the new Retina MacBook Pros have been put out. So you might not even be able to get that. You might have to wait till the Mountain Lion update or until there is a 10.7.5 update before you can get the combo updates that will apply to the new MacBook Pros. Barring that, you're probably going to have to start by installing from the disk that comes with your MacBook Pro. Use that disk or USB key. I don't even know if they're including that anymore, if you just get it through the Mac App Store with Lion. I don't know how that works with the recovery disk. I can't remember. It's failing me. My memory's failing me right now. I think you actually can download it from the Mac App Store and apply it. So if you can download it from the Mac App Store and install it, maybe it'll have all the latest updates for that Retina MacBook Pro. I don't really know, but it's probably worth a shot. And by the same token, if you are already booting off of an external drive and you need to take that to another Mac or a newer Mac and it's not working for you, you might try booting from that external drive and applying the combo update to that version of the operating system. Of course, with all this stuff, make sure that you have backups and, you know, you don't want to be messing around with your operating system too much if you don't have a full backup. In the same email, Jeff also pointed out that if you run OS X Lion Server, there is an option to have your home folder created and stored on another volume. You can have a remote user account and have all your home folder information over there. You know, this is a little bit a different solution than I think we were looking for in the last episode, where he wanted to be able to take all his applications, the operating system, and user folders and everything and have that shared between two different pieces of hardware, a Mac at home and a Mac at work. But if you're looking for just having a mobile home folder, this is actually something you can set up, and you really don't even need OS X Lion Server. OS X Lion Server kind of has built-in support for it, makes it pretty easy. Chris Breen over at Macworld actually covered how you can set this up in Mac OS X Client, and so I'll link to that full article at macworld.com in the show notes, but you can do this. I'm going to cover some of the steps here and show you where to look to do this stuff, but I am going to caveat it with a warning. Be very careful if you try this. It's an advanced procedure, and I'm only giving you kind of an overview of it. If you don't follow the steps exactly and you mess this up, if you mess up your home folder, bad things could happen. You could not be able to get access to your system. You may have to reinstall Mac OS X. So needless to say, make sure that you have backups before you even attempt this, and make sure you also understand and sort of know what you're doing, know what's going on here. But what you can do is you can connect, say, an external volume to your Mac and then copy your home folder to any location on that drive. So just go into the home folder on your hard drive, your boot hard drive, copy that folder over to the external drive, wherever you'd like to put that. You're probably going to have to authenticate to do the copy. You need heightened permission, so it'll ask you for your admin login. But once you do that, copy it over. Make sure that you leave the home folder in place on your internal drive for now, so you'll now have two copies. And then once that's been copied over to the external drive, go in, open up your system preferences, go into users and groups. And I'm giving you the instructions if you're running Lion, very similar if you're running another operating system, but I believe it was user system preferences accounts in Snow Leopard. But in Lion, go into system preferences, users and groups. You're probably going to have to click the lock down in the left-hand corner to make changes. Enter your admin credentials. And then find the username for the account that you want to move the home folder to the external drive for. Control or right-click on that username. And then choose the advanced options. And then a little panel is going to slide down. And there's a bunch of things in there. A lot of it looks really technical. But you're going to look for the section that says home directory. There's a home directory field. And you'll notice that it has the current path to your home folder on your internal drive. Next to that, there's a little choose button. Click the choose button and then navigate to the home folder that you moved onto the external drive. Select it and click open. And now the path should update and change. And you should notice it's the path pointing to the home folder on the external drive. You can now exit the system preferences and test the system to make sure everything is working, that your user account is still working with the stuff being contained and accessed from the external drive rather than the internal drive. And that's pretty much it for moving it. The one thing you want to make sure that you do, though, is you have an admin level user account that's still on the internal drive. So if you're like most people only have one user account on their machine, and that user account is the one they set up when they set up their Mac, that's an admin level account by default. So unless you did anything to change that, you move just that account to the external drive, you're probably going to want to set up a new admin account on the internal drive just in case anything goes wrong. Because if you don't have a home folder on the internal drive, you only have it on the external, and that external drive goes kaput, you're not going to be able to get in to do anything with your system. You're not going to have any way to access it. So you're going to want to always have an account on the internal drive so you can boot up from the Mac and get it up and running. But once you're 100% sure everything is working, you can log into the Mac with that new admin account. You can log in using the home folder on the external volume when it's connected. Once you're sure everything is absolutely working, if you want, you could go back in at that point and then delete the home folder that you moved to the external drive from the internal drive, and you should be all set. There's the overview. I have personally never run my Mac this way. It frankly makes me a little bit nervous. I know a lot of people do it. A lot of people move their home folder. They use this technique. People have told me it's safe, so I'm sharing the information with you. But just one more reminder, you know, please be careful doing this. And if something goes horribly wrong, don't blame me. I gave you the warning. The one thing I'm not sure about is if you could use a home folder on an external drive with Mac OS X installed on two different Macs. So if you repeated this procedure, say in that last example where you wanted to work on a Mac in your with your home Mac and a work Mac, and you just had the home folder on the external drive, if you could point each one of those at that home folder, would that work? I have really no idea. It seems to me in theory that it should work, especially if you're running the same exact operating system, same exact version of the operating system on both machines, if you have the same apps installed. I don't see any technical reason why I can't imagine it wouldn't work. But if anybody has tried that, has worked with a user folder that's on an external drive that you move between two different machines, let us know. I'd be curious to know how that works and if you've run into any issues or problems or anything like that. The last method that I thought I'd mention, though, and this relates to the home folder, and this is something I think I'd be a little bit more comfortable with, is you can keep a home folder in sync between two different Macs using a program called ChronoSync. They actually have instructions on their website for doing what they call a home-to-home sync, and I'll link to their article in the show notes at maccast.com. It's Econ Technologies. I actually use ChronoSync with my Drobo, which I have connected to a Mac Mini on my network, to copy and keep in sync certain folders of important data. So like my projects folder, my websites folders and stuff like that. My music folder for my for iTunes, or my media folder, I guess I should say. I have that all nightly ChronoSynced over to my Drobo, so that if anything should happen, it's just another backup area of files that I can go back and get access to. In order for that to work, they actually have a companion application called Chrono Agent that makes the volume on the network drive constantly available to ChronoSync to sync. But they do have this ability to sync two home folders between two different Macs over a network. So you might look into that if you just want to have two Macs. Maybe a common one I'm getting a lot these days is somebody has a MacBook Air and then they maybe have an iMac and they want to make sure that their home documents and everything are in sync between those two. So when you're at home and have them both connected to the network, you could have a ChronoSync set up to sync the home folders to each other. And that way, both Macs always have the same files. They always have the same data and same information. Again, this is a feature that I haven't personally used, but I know ChronoSync is a reliable bit of software. They've been around for a long time. And like I said, they do have the instructions on their website. So it should work very well. I want to touch on a topic that has started to come up in the community quite a bit recently. And it's related to Macs and their upgradability. You know, Apple has been, especially in their notebooks, driving down the size of devices. They've been locking down the devices quite a bit more. They're getting some flack for it, but they're also getting accolades for it because we want these small, slim designs, and we want great battery life, and we want all this stuff. So the Retina MacBook Pro comes out, and I think it was iFixit that gave it like the worst rating for upgradability, expandability, repairability, all those sorts of things. And that's begun this kind of debate that, you know, is Apple building more systems with custom designs and closed architectures as they are doing this? Is this bad for us as consumers, not having the ability to upgrade our devices? Are they forcing us into sort of systems that have a limited shelf life, that we're going to be forced to buy new machines. And so this is forced repeat business for Apple. Or is this really just Apple trying to drive the technology forward? It's an interesting debate to have. You know, with the MacBook Pros, the display is fused to the glass, creating a single assembly. So if something goes wrong with your screen, it's going to be a more expensive part to repair. You can't repair just one part of it and not the other. You have to buy the whole entire unit. Another example is that the RAM is soldered onto the motherboard. So if you don't order it with the maximum amount of RAM that you want, you can't go back in with the Retina MacBook Pro and add more RAM later. So you have to think, one, a little bit more when you're making your buying decision. How much RAM am I really going to need? And then, two, if I hit my limit, if I don't get the right amount, well, then what am I going to do? I have to buy a new machine if I want to get more RAM. And it's quite an expensive RAM upgrade. You know, luckily, Apple's brought the cost of adding additional RAM and build-to-order options down a bit, but still, it's not as cheap as you could get it if you were able to buy it yourself and install it. So these are legitimate issues. Custom batteries are another one. Apple went to sealed battery technology a long time ago. And if you want to get a new battery in current generation MacBook Pros, you have to bring it to Apple. You have to have them replace the battery for you in most cases. I mean, there are ways to do it yourself if you want to get in there. But, you know, with the new Retina MacBook Pros, the batteries are actually custom shaped and they're glued into the case. So it does make replacing those quite a bit more difficult. And even the flash modules, the flash storage modules and drives, they're not standard drives that are in there. They have special shapes and non-standard connectors. And you can, yeah, once again, get in there and replace them. But it is a little bit more difficult. And, you know, that caused some changes to go on. This past week, there was a whole controversy. Apple reported that they were going to remove their products from the Electronic Product Environmental Assessment Tool, the EPEAT standard, which they had been promoting for a really long time. It's actually a standard that Apple went in and kind of helped set. And a lot of the speculation was one of the reasons Apple was having to remove their products from the EPEAT standards was that one of the requirements is that they need to be able to be easily disassembled for recycling. So despite the fact that Apple uses really environmentally friendly materials in terms of arsenic-free glass and aluminum, this stuff that can be recycled, you have to be able to tear that stuff apart. And with the direction that Apple hardware is moving in, you can't pull that stuff and disassemble it very easily. So there was a lot of speculation that that's why Apple was withdrawing. It caused a lot of controversy because many government organizations, educational institutions, and stuff like that require that systems meet EPEAT standards in order for them to be able to purchase them. So I think almost immediately the city of San Francisco said, well, we're not going to be able to use Macs now that you're not on the EPEAT standard, or you're not submitting for the EPEAT certification. And that immediately caused Apple a few days later to withdraw their decision to not submit their stuff for EPEAT. As a matter of fact, Apple's VP of hardware engineering, Bob Mansfield, had to do a public retraction. They issued a statement, said, yes, we are going to work with the standards organization again. We're going to help get our products on the list. We're going to recertify them and stuff like that. So, that's good news. It turned out to be good in the end. EPEAT, just so you know, does not do certifications for smartphones or tablets. So the iPad, the iPhone don't fall under this. This is desktops and laptops and stuff like that. And Apple meets really high standards, energy standards like Energy Star. I think they're above and beyond the government certifications for Energy Star. So we know that Apple has worked hard to make their systems environmentally friendly. It was just the sort of one standard that they seemed to pull back on. And again, a lot of the speculation was surrounding the fact that you can't upgrade these things, you can't disassemble these things, and this was part of the problem. So the question becomes, is this trend bad for us as Apple consumers? And, you know, I've been thinking about this just for me personally, and I think it does come down to this. It's going to be personal for a lot of people. It goes back to a lot of the conversations we've been having about what's the future of the Mac Pro? Is a definition of a Pro system a system that you can upgrade, that you can expand, that you can put PCI cards in? Or is it something else? If it's out of the box, has the right specifications, can it be considered a quote-unquote Pro Macintosh? And I have to admit that for myself, there are only two kinds of upgrades in recent years that I've ever done to any of my Macs, and that would be upgrading RAM and upgrading hard drives. And I think those are legitimate, reasonable upgrades to allow consumers to perform on their Macs. Technology changes so rapidly and so quickly, especially with respect to the costs of hard drives, the costs of SSDs that we're seeing now. I mean, they're dropping dramatically overnight. Sizes are going up. We always need more storage. We always need more RAM. So the ability to upgrade that stuff is pretty critical moving forward. Although in more recent years, again, being very, very honest about this stuff, I've really only done RAM upgrades. And in most cases, when I need to expand my storage, I've turned to external solutions. I've bought bigger external hard drives, FireWire 800, and I'll probably be in the future buying Thunderbolt drives to attach on there and using that for storage. So, and machines are coming with more and more RAM out of the box built in. I believe the Retina MacBook Pro is 8 gigabytes standard. So, you know, is that enough RAM for most people? How big a deal is this really? So I'm throwing this question out there and wanting to start the conversation, not just for myself, but to throw it out to you and say, you know, what do you think? Do you think that to call a system Pro, that it needs to have this kind of upgradability? Or, you know, is it okay if out of the box it comes with sort of quote unquote Pro specs? You know, is it a deal breaker to a lot of users that you can't upgrade or easily upgrade these systems? And is that type of user, the person who wants to get in there and hack and update and upgrade these systems, are they a dwindling breed of user? SSD sizes are growing. Prices are dropping, you know, like I said. So, and then you have things like Apple has added Thunderbolt, which is essentially an external USB, or excuse me, external PCI Express slot. You know, it has the ability to attach a box that you could have a breakout box and you could put all kinds of expansion cards in there. So you can do a lot of things under Thunderbolt that you normally would have to open up the case to do, and you can do all that externally. Similarly, you know, USB 3 is a pretty fast standard for hard drives. So can you get away with running some of this stuff externally, or does that kind of take away from the whole Pro concept? And, you know, I do think that not having this expandability in some cases, at least in the past, would mean having to buy a new Mac maybe sooner than you normally would like. I generally like to keep my Macs for about 3 to 5 years, and more often I would find I'd be keeping a Mac for 5 years, and a big part of my ability to do that has been the ability to upgrade the hard drive or upgrade the RAM and eke a little bit more longevity out of that system. So the thought about that going away, the sealed battery thing, you know, I thought that was going to be a problem for me. It has not yet, although I haven't had to replace one of my internal batteries, and Apple seems to be sort of driving the price up on that as time has gone along. I believe when they first had the sealed batteries, the update, you know, if you needed to get a new battery installed by Apple, I think was around $129. I think some models are around $149 US, and the Retina MacBook Pro now, I believe, is $199. So you got to plan 2 to 3 years down the line. Lithium ion batteries, just they run their course depending upon your usage pattern. You're looking at a $200 battery upgrade at that point. But I think even when we had external batteries, those were the price ranges they were in. So it's just a matter of pop it in yourself or have to drop it off at the Genius Bar for a couple hours. So again, I don't know that this trend is necessarily bad, especially considering that in order to meet some of the design requirements to get these things as thin as possible, as you know, custom as possible as Apple is doing, and get the best performance out of it, they are having to attach stuff to the motherboard so that it can be faster. They're having to build these custom shaped batteries and fit them into these tiny spaces so that they can eke the absolute longest battery life out of it. And a lot of people would point to and say, speed is more of a factor in a Pro system. Battery life is more of a factor in a Pro system than actually, can I expand it or upgrade it later? I'm going to get the system that I can use now with the maximum amount of RAM. If it's a Pro system, maximum amount of RAM, maximum amount of storage. I'm just going to trick this thing out. And that to me is a Pro system. So, you know, what makes Pro? And I guess that's kind of the question I'm throwing out there. So send me some feedback, mattcast@gmail.com, and I look forward to hearing from you. And I guess finally today, somewhat related to this concept of older Macs and longevity of systems and upgrading and stuff like that is the fact that I've been pretty vocal, I don't know on this show yet, but several other shows, about my feelings that I think Apple has pulled a real jerk move in locking users of older Macs that can't run OS X Lion out of iCloud, and specifically the features of iCloud syncing. If they didn't do anything else, if they didn't offer any other functionality, I wish they would have at least just offered syncing functionality. And I'm talking about syncing calendars, contacts, bookmarks, all those sorts of things. Syncing functionality for Snow Leopard users. There are a lot of old Macs that are still up and running, still useful systems that a lot of people use on a daily basis that just simply can't upgrade to Lion because their system doesn't support it. But now you're going to tell them they can't just do basic syncing with iCloud with their iOS devices. Most of these people have iPhones, they have they have iPads, iPod touches, and they don't want to just throw out or have to upgrade their system. And to me, this does feel like a move that's sort of forcing people to buy new hardware, maybe before they need to or required to, just to get some basic functionality that is, you know, their system's perfectly capable of running. I had said on a few shows, if someone can point me to the technical limitation, I'll pull back on my feelings about Apple being jerky on this. But I just really think that they didn't make the right move. I kept hoping and waiting for this last minute reprieve and Apple saying, okay, we have an update for Snow Leopard that'll allow you to do this stuff. And I think only proving my point this week is I received an email from Jason, and he pointed me to a couple sites that show you how you can actually hack your iCal in Snow Leopard. And it's not even a hack. That's not a good word. How you can configure iCal in Snow Leopard to work with Apple's iCloud servers. So if you want to get your calendar syncing back, you can actually do this. And I actually tried this trick out on my old Mac Mini, and I've only had time to do some limited simple tests. I didn't use it extensively, but from what I can tell, it works, and it works beautifully. Obviously unsupported by Apple, so if you do this, they're not going to help you out, and Apple could at any time change something on the iCloud servers that would potentially break this workaround. But I thought I'd share the workaround with you because it does seem to work very well. And the reason it works so well is that Apple actually uses a standard. They use the CalDAV standard server technology with iCal, and the iCal client in Snow Leopard supports connecting to a CalDAV server. So really all you have to do to get this to work is manually enter the server information, and the only thing that's a little bit tricky is actually getting that server information. But once you have that, you can plug it into the software, and it should sync just fine. So basically, what you need to know is you need to know the dedicated iCloud server that is used for your account, for your iCloud account, and that it connects to. And the easiest way that I found to do that was to use Safari and access the iCloud website, the web-based version of iCal, and you can get the information from there. So what you do is you go to iCloud.com, you log in, you go into the calendar service, access the calendar in your browser, and then in Safari, go under the window menu, under activity, and expand that out. And the section that you're looking for, you're going to look for a URL that begins with the letter P and then a two-digit number, usually a zero number. So it'll be like P02, P03, P04. Where I found it was in my case, it was P04-keyvalueservice.icloud.com. There was also a listing for P04-contacts.icloud.com. So you're looking for that URL. And it's that P with the two-digit number that is the significant one. That's the one that you want to remember. So note what that two-digit number is, 0204, whatever it might be. And that's what's going to indicate your dedicated server. And that's the bit of information that you're going to need to enter later when you're going into set up iCal. So once you have that information, you can go to iCloud on, you can go into iCal on Snow Leopard and just set up a new CalDAV server. I got this information and these steps over on macOS10hints.com, so I'll have a link to that article in the show notes at maccast.com if you need to review this. But what you need to do is you just need to make sure that you have the latest version of iCal running under Snow Leopard. That should be version 4.0.4. I believe the build number is 1395.7. So just go under, you know, get info or under the, excuse me, iCal menu and choose about iCal and it'll have that information for you. Just verify. If you don't have that version, make sure that you run your software updates and get up to date. But once you have that, then just go into the iCal preferences from the iCal menu, go over to the accounts tab, and then you're going to click the plus symbol to add a new account. You're going to select the CalDAV account type and then enter your username, which is going to be your iCloud.me email address, and then enter your iCloud password, and then you need to put in the server address. And the server address is going to be that P04 number in my case, or P0X, whatever you recorded when you checked it in Safari, -caldav.icloud.com. So you put in that as your server, and then after this step, what you should see is you should see the calendars show up in iCal over there on the left. Now, there, after you do that, there's a couple more things you need to check. You're not completely set up yet. So once you've done that, still while you're in the settings there for the CalDAV server, select your account that you just set up and then go into the server settings tab. In there, check the server path value and make sure that it's using the newer iCloud format. By default, I think if you've already had iCloud set up to connect to MobileMe, it's going to have the older MobileMe path. So what the path should look like is it should have your dedicated account number, and that should already be entered in there, slash, and then the word principal. If it says something like principals slash users slash one dot and then your account number, that's the old style, and you need to change it to be just simply your dedicated account number, so you can just copy and paste that, and then slash principal. And then in the port number, make sure that the port number is set to 443 and that the use SSL button or checkbox is checked. You can set the port manually. I think it might be unnecessary because 443 is the default SSL port. So I would assume if you just check the SSL box that it will already automatically use 443. But if that's not working, go ahead and just enter 443 as the port number and it should work. And once you've verified all that, you should be able to restart iCal, refresh your calendar, and it should be connecting to the CalDAV server and syncing up with iCloud just fine. And so if you enter a new entry into iCal, it should show up over on iCloud and vice versa. And it did seem to work for me just fine. So I know a follow-up question a lot of you are going to have is, if I can do this for calendar, can I do it for contacts? And the short answer is that there does appear to be some ways to do it, because similarly to iCal, or how iCal works with a CalDAV server, there is such a thing as a CardDAV server, and Contacts uses a CardDAV server to do its syncing. Unfortunately, I think it's a little bit of a deeper hack. It requires some manual hacking of the plist files, at least as near as I could tell. There's a Tidbits article that goes into some of this, has some links over to some other articles you can check out. You might be able to get the contact syncing set up, but I did not have time to dive into that. I played around with it a little bit. There were some versions that said you could do it just in the same way as we just did the iCal hack, where you could just plug in to the settings some information and get it working. I wasn't able to get that to work. So I do think you're going to have to go in and tweak some of the settings actually in the plist files, which, again, a little bit deeper hack, and I didn't want to really go into that, but I have links in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to dive into this further. But, you know, it only proves my point that Apple could make this happen, I think, for Snow Leopard users, and they're just choosing not to, which just really gets in my craw for whatever reason. So there you go. I hope that helps some of you Snow Leopard users out, at least with connecting to iCloud on your, you know, for your calendar syncing. And with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, check out their software as well as get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen for iPad. Awesome software. You should check it all out. You can get free trials and more information over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, if you need to get cash for an old iPhone, for an old Mac, it's a great place to go. If you don't want to deal with the hassles of an auction site or a classified service, you can simply go to gazelle.com, enter some information about your device, tell them what kind of device you have, and get an upfront cash offer. Great service, quick and easy to use. Check it out, gazelle.com. And Apollon, makers of Pimp Your Screen, a great way to build custom home screens, desktops for your iOS devices. They allow you to layer in these cool shelves, little neon backgrounds behind your icons. Basically bling out your home screen if you want to do that. And you can get more information on their software over at Apollon.com or just find them in the App Store, Pimp Your Screen. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. And, of course, a big thank you to you for your support. Thank you for staying subscribed. Thank you for all of your feedback. If you would like to get a hold of me, if you have a comment, a question, a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send those to me. Audio comments are very welcome. Also, just emails are great. MacCast@gmail.com is the email address. Or you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Leave voicemail there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this episode or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. It's a great place to get your questions answered. Just hang out and chat with a bunch of the other Mac geeks in the MacCast community. It's really like a little family over there. So, you know, if you need to get a question answered, if you have something to contribute, I really recommend that you go over and sign up. It's free. Check it out over at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, and also check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And with that, that's going to do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.